From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Forbes publisher and self-proclaimed late bloomer, Rich Karlgaard, who has written Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Karlgaard writes that the executive function of our brains doesn't mature until we're 25 or older, and by one recent study suggests that peak innovation age is in fact in our late 40s. By assuming we aren't capable of success just because we haven't discovered our talents by a certain age, or by not hiring older workers because we assume that they're past their prime, well, we're shortcoming ourselves and the world. And this trend not only damages the children we're pushing, but also vastly limits our potential to contribute to society precisely when we have the most to offer. Rich Karlgaard, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Pleasure to be with you, John.
Oh, it's great to have you. We both very much enjoyed the book and been looking forward to this conversation. Maybe we can start out by you telling your own story of being a late bloomer.
Sure. I went to a good university. After going to the local junior college, I transferred to Stanford, but it was back in the day when Stanford was a much easier institution to get into. And rather than taking advantage of that splendid opportunity, I squandered it. I took the easiest classes that were in the catalog called the Mickey Mouse curriculum, and I barely got through. So at age 25, when my roommates were off in grad school and doing amazing things, I was capable of holding a job of no greater responsibility than dishwasher, security guard, and temp typist. And one night when I was 25, I was still a security guard, and I was walking the perimeter of a trucking yard where my current posting was, and I heard a dog barking. I swung my flashlight around, and there in the yard next door was a Rottweiler. And it occurred to me that at age 25, my professional colleague was a dog.
Oh.
Then, a few months after that, Steve Jobs, also 25, took Apple public, and I thought, my God, I've really fallen far. And my brain just wasn't ready to handle any responsibility. Through a temp typist job when I was 26, I got the opportunity to be a technical writer at a research institute. And that was the first time in my life where I approached the job seriously and went in with a spirit of learning. And my whole brain began to blossom. I literally felt this opening up of new pathways and new ways of thinking. I was working with engineers. I'd never thought like an engineer or had that kind of systematic planning view of life the way they do. And it was just hugely beneficial. Had you given me that opportunity at age 23, you know, I would have squandered it again. I have no doubt about that. That's why I say I'm a late bloomer. Now, I think it's back in my day. You already know, at least by age, if not by net worth, I was a contemporary and peer of the late Steve Jobs. I think it's much harder to be that late bloomer today because we put such extraordinary pressure on kids and young adults to achieve big and achieve early in measurable ways, whether in school or sports or extracurriculars, oftentimes driven by this desire to get into the most elite and expensive university that you can, which then leads to debt that overwhelms a lot of families. We have higher rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide among teens and young adults than we've ever seen. So I think you step back and you say, this extreme early pressure, is it doing society any good? Well, some people are popping out of that, and they're good, and maybe maybe they got motivated by that. But I think for the vast majority of people, we've carried this idea of hyper-meritocracy at an early age to an extreme, and it's become harmful.
And it also gets in the way of curiosity and discovery as we push these kids to get perfect SAT scores and to just focus on those types of results, doesn't it?
Well, you put it perfectly. I'm glad you got that point in the book. That essentially what we're doing is asking kids to trade their curiosity for a determined focus. Curiosity and the plasticity of our brains when we're young you know, that's a really holy alliance. It's we'll never get that sort of peak age where curiosity can do us that kind of good. Now, late bloomers tend to be those who say, to heck with all these external motivations. I am going to be curious. Some of us are just immature. Some of us are curious. I was both. When I was screwing off in college, I was actually, when it was so hard to do my homework, even in the easy courses, I would wander off into the library stacks, and I loved magazines, and I read every issue of Sports Illustrated from its inception year in 1954 through the present. I learned about great writing. I learned about great magazines doing that. None of that did me any good as a student. But years later, when I had the opportunity with a friend to start what became Silicon Valley's first business magazine, and I was the editor and designer, I said, aha, I'm gonna make the Sports Illustrated of Silicon Valley business. It's going to have that attitude. It's going to be cheeky. It's going to have great headlines, great captions, all of that stuff. It's going to have great illustration. And we did. And within a couple of years, the magazine was getting the attention of people like Bill Gates. Bill Gates gave me 4 hours of interviews, which then caught the attention of Steve Forbes, who hired me. So, you know, my curiosity did me no good in the short term, and my immature brain wouldn't have known what to do with it anyway. But it was a stored memory that turned out to be my career maker.
That's such a great story. If you're just joining us, our guest is Rich Karlgaard. He's the author of a new book called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. He's also tied into this story of his love and curiosity surrounding magazines. He's the publisher of Forbes magazine. So it is interesting, Rich, that you talk about, you know, you probably never paid attention to those curiosities because really to you, it meant that you were procrastinating on your other studies, on your Mickey Mouse curriculum. And you, I mean, luckily it was a repressed memory that somehow came out later. We can really serve ourselves much better, can't we, by paying attention to those little skills, aptitudes, curiosities that we don't give ourselves credit for because we're busy pigeonholing ourselves as, you know, we're not accomplishing what we ought to be.
Well, that's absolutely right. And this conveyor belt that we've constructed that treats kids like some kind of machine, and they're going along the conveyor belt, taking tests, taking advanced placement courses, all under the gun of extraordinary pressure and the feeling of shame if they aren't one of the superstars. What it's doing is revealing a very narrow range of skills and abilities. People are good at taking tests. People are good at focusing. And you think about all the full range of what I think are God-given talents, from artistic talents to spatial talents. You name them. You think about all of those talents that go undiscovered on this conveyor belt. So think about somebody who might be a brilliant potential carpenter, but how is carpentry ever going to get discovered if the kid didn't have a summer job, you know, in carpentry? And the parents are pressuring the kid to be a university student and to get into the best university that they can. There's a guy from your neck of the woods who's now at Harvard named Todd Rose. Todd Rose grew up in Ogden, I believe. And he almost flunked out of high school. He became kind of the class clown because he found it useful to be a class clown because it would protect him from the bullies. The bullies wouldn't beat him up if he were the class clown. And so he did very poorly in high school, and then he went off to Weber State, and he made a really great decision. He said, I'm not going to take any class, no matter how interested I might be in it, if I run into anybody I know from high school. Because to them, I'm pigeonholed and typecast as the class clown. And I know I'll fall into that trap. Mm. And so he did that. And then he decided to take the classes that really interested him, that he was curious about, no matter whether they were advanced classes, you know, for juniors and seniors, or whether they were freshman classes. So he did it entirely backwards. He took the classes that he liked first, even though they were advanced classes, And then he did the mandatory stuff that is usually given to freshmen and sophomores. And he did well enough following that course. Oh, and he learned on a standardized test. He'd always been tripped up by word logic problems. And then he had a discussion about this with his dad. And his dad said, well, you're always a pretty good geometry student. Even when you're a crappy student overall in high school, you're always good at that. Why don't you diagram the problem? So he learned how to diagram a written problem in some sort of, you know, geometric drawing, and suddenly understood how to answer word logic problems. And doing all of that, he goes from Weber State to Harvard grad school. Now he runs a center at Harvard for the mind and learning. I mean, an extraordinary case of a late bloomer. You can read all about it in his book, The End of Average.
You talk in your book about Elizabeth Holmes, and she, of course, ran that scam that was you could prick the end of your finger to do a blood test, and it was going to revolutionize the world of testing, and she raised a tremendous amount of money. You talk about her as this, she had such a drive to have early achievement, and, you know, about how it went wrong. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. You know, Theranos was going to do this great blood diagnostic technology with just the finger prick, and it didn't work as they'd hoped, and they lied about it, and everybody by now knows the story. It's been an HBO movie. There's a best-selling book on it, and now everybody's jumping on Elizabeth Holmes. She's a sociopath. She might even be psychopathic. She's a criminal, and all of that might be true, but I kind of prefer to give her a little benefit of the doubt that nobody wants to give now. Everybody gave her way too much benefit of the doubt, and now they don't give her any at all. And she was a prodigy. She was a computer programmer. As a kid, she learned the Chinese language as a teen, did all the things that sort of marked her as a 99.99 cognitively gifted, ambitious person. And she started Theranos. She talked her college advisor into joining the board of the company, for crying out loud. Very persuasive. Her model was Steve Jobs. And she borrowed a lot of Jobs' mannerisms, wearing a black mock turtleneck shirt, steepling her hands, staring intimidatingly at people. And Jobs did a lot of that. I think she got so trapped by her own story of being this prodigy who's able to raise all the money you alluded to. And when things went sideways, she wasn't able to deal with it realistically. She got trapped by her own picture of being the kid who never did anything wrong. And maybe like Bernie Madoff, the question around him is similarly, you know, was he a born crook or did he become that way? I think he became that way because what happened was is that he suddenly failed to make the returns on investment that he had promised his investors. So he raised new money, and he took the new money and paid off the old investors at the promised rate of return. He got himself in a hole like an addicted gambler. And I think for a while he figured out, if I just hit it, you know, just give me enough time. And then he got in it so deep that he lost all sense of morality and ethics and became a real criminal.
Yeah. Rich, I understand the problem that schools and employers, they overvalue early achievement. They look at late blooming as almost a deficiency. But the real crime here is that we've got kids that believe that they're inferior based on, you know, maybe some bad test scores when they were younger or their inability to take tests very well. And so the question I have for you is, when you were talking earlier about going into the stacks and going into SI back to 1954, and that informed you for this spectacularly successful magazine of yours. What you didn't talk about was maybe the shaming experience that you had. I mean, you had a roommate named Bob. He got straight A's. He went on to Stanford Law. He had a backpack with a couple highlighters and a pen and a pad of paper, and he would go into the stacks, and you tried to emulate that with the same backpack, the same, you know.
And a quart of Pepsi for the caffeine and the sugar. Yeah, I thought maybe that was the secret to why he was able to study 4 hours at a stretch other than urinal breaks and then go back and type up a 30-page double-spaced paper and ace everything he touched and make Phi Beta Kappa in his junior year, et cetera.
So how did that make you feel?
I felt a profound sense of shame.
Yeah.
There's just no question about that. I mean, I was slow to come into physical maturity as going from childhood to adolescence. And I think that kind of put me behind the eight ball right away. And so I almost look at the ages of 12 to 27, other than little brief exceptions, you know, winning a road race here as a runner or pulling off the upset of getting into Stanford, which I really didn't deserve to get into. Mostly that 12 to 26 time span I just was flatlining in terms of intellectual growth, confidence, all that stuff. I just think now you take all of that and you multiply it by 10 for this kid who might have an identical experience today because of the early pressures, the idea that you didn't get into the college of your dreams, that somehow you're second rate. I mean, where I live in Silicon Valley, the San Francisco Bay Area and Silicon Valley prides itself on this wide-ranging diversity that we tolerate differently gendered people, people of all skin colors, people, you know, all of that. And it does. And it's part of the reason Silicon Valley, I think, is successful or at least unique in the world, where it is the very opposite of diverse is in its tolerance for anybody who isn't super bright. I mean, Steve Jobs used to throw the word bozo around to describe people who weren't as smart as he was. Well, that's a high bar. And the same kind of, you detect it. It's sort of the last acceptable prejudice in a place like Silicon Valley is the prejudice against not only the quote-unquote stupid, but the slow or even merely above average. And it's sort of like they look at their high IQs and their 800 math SAT scores and their ability to raise money from top-tier venture capitalists, sort of like the way you'd look at a college prospect at the NFL Combine. You know, you'll never be a running back in the NFL if you don't break, let's say, 4.6 in the 40, no matter how well you did in college, no matter that you might have won the Heisman in college. You know, there's this idea that's equivalent in Silicon Valley that if you're not one of the cognitive elite, God help you. We need people like you, but you're not one of us.
Because you state that, you know, the company with the highest valuation, Apple, person that runs it is Tim Cook, who is gay. So everybody thinks, well, you know, we've really moved the bar for diversity. We're doing well. But you're talking about cognitive diversity.
Cognitive diversity, this belief that algorithmic genius is the only kind of intelligence that matters. And there are people who are enlightened about this, but there's still a mismatch between what they say and what they do. Fortune magazine asked a bunch of CEOs, including the CEO of Intuit and Genentech, what do you value most in your employees? And the word that popped up most was curiosity, mm-hmm. and resilience, communication skills, compassion. And yet, well, are you screening for that? Is your HR process allowing that in? How do you even measure for that? So people right. default to what they can measure, and they can measure test scores, grades, where your college ranked on the U.S. News and World Report ranking or some other ranking. And so people default to that, even though they know a lot of those people don't get that much better after the age of 25 or so because they're revealed to have been really good at rote learning with not an ounce of creativity or independent thinking in them.
Well, Rich, we are out of time, but a couple of things. One is we just want to thank you for writing this comprehensive book on late bloomers, and it's a hopeful book, and I think that's the bottom line. It's a book that tells you that maybe your kids or your godson or your cousin or whoever, that there's a lot of hope there. So thanks for writing it, Rich.
Yes,
Carlgren.
We have unfolding gifts for the many decades of our lives, and if we work to stay as physically healthy as we can and we stay mentally engaged, we can have an amazing life and an intellectually stimulating life for a long time.
The name of the book, Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Rich, thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.